Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock on BCFM 93.2. This week we talk to local therapist Gary McFarlane. Jason Yannakopoulos is looking at positive action. Also go back to the beginning of last month to the May Day rally in Castle Park and hear another one of the speeches by the trade unionists, this time from Rowena Haywood, who's from the General Municipal and Boilermakers, the GMB union. Also the next stop on our tour of the universe with Paul Fernie. But we start this week with our guest Gary McFarlane. Hi Gary, and welcome to Dialect.
A privilege to be here, Tony.
Now first of all, tell us about your therapy, because you did hit the headlines a couple of months ago, didn't you?
I did, and I guess the best way, just an everyday Bristolian minding his own business, seeking to earn a living, deciding to do a career change from the law to therapy. And I hit some obstacles, which after 5 years, I think it's resolved now.
But first of all, why did you decide to leave the law, and what were you doing in the legal profession?
I was a solicitor for some 24 years, and as I was sort of around the 20 years into the profession, I started to lose my enjoyment of the law. Various combination of stuff. Everything was changing in terms of legal aid, inability to really help people, truly help people, all sorts of things. Just waking up in the mornings, going off to work, treading water. It was good for paying the mortgage, school fees, etc. But there was dissatisfaction.
I want to get into that a little bit,
okay.
Because I mean, as a lawyer, very few of us see the real inner workings of the way the law works. We may, you know, deal with a lawyer for a short period of time to do with one particular case, but if you're dealing with it day to day, what was it that you felt was starting to be removed from the enjoyment that you'd initially had as a lawyer? Obviously, it's quite nice advocating for somebody,
sure,
particularly if you believe that maybe that they're the little guy that's been wronged, or even the big guy that's been wronged. But if you think that you can actually contribute to justice, that must be immensely rewarding, and it sounds to me as if maybe that was fading from what you were doing.
Exactly that, Tony. Immensely rewarding. It was really quite hard searching for me to do this, because I'm one of those rare breeds, quite specialised in that I was a clinical negligence lawyer, or medical negligence. So I started out acting for the hospitals. Indeed, one of the key hospitals was the UBHT, or at the time Bristol Western Health Authority, moved to London, moved to Manchester to get the best training in clinical negligence, acting for the NHS. And then I did something radical, which seems to be the story of my life. I decided to change sides, to act for the patients, to use all that knowledge to come to bear in their hospital, dental, other medical related treatments that go wrong, and help them to wade through the maze of trying to get justice. The fact that so often there are adverse outcomes in the NHS in the surgery, but the doctors, the medics won't always quite do the right thing in terms of proper explanations. And what changed for me fundamentally is legal aid was going, so patients actually couldn't afford to pay for the services. Me as a partner, quite senior, therefore obviously quite costly. But my passion was to help people get justice. But if they can't pay my fees, then they can't really get justice. And then no win, no fee was coming in, and then there were massive satellite litigation at the end of the cases as to how much should be paid to the lawyers, and that was taking up so much time trying to fight another law firm to try and get a right amount of payment once the case had finished, that it really was sapping of energy. And trying to find ways for the patient to be able to pay us, checking, have you got some form of legal expenses cover with your home contents insurance? I've called that one of the best kept secrets of the insurance industry. Many people with legal expenses cover on their house contents didn't actually know they had it. And trying to help them then to find a way to pay me. But I was doing more of that than I was getting on and helping them to get justice. And I was really losing my enjoyment big time. And I'd always had a great interest in counselling. More than that, actually, I find myself back in the 80s, one of the founder members of actually a key counselling agency here in Bristol whilst I was a trainee solicitor.
But before we get into the counselling, what would you say now to those who are the vast majority of operations and encounters with the health service are successful and fine, which is worth saying. But if things do go wrong, what can people do nowadays? Is it really just as difficult as you're describing there? It's actually going to be, you're not going to be able to get any money? And if so, for example, to take a case against, if you feel that, you know, something's, say, for example, something as silly as a medical instrument has been left inside someone's body, which does happen after an operation, how is it possible to take something like that forward? Is it possible nowadays?
It is possible. One should always be looking at the complaints procedure first and foremost. That's really something you'd need some guidance through, and there's supposed to be a patient's pile to help you with that complaints process. And the NHS is supposed to be that much better in giving apologies. I have to say, just last week I had cause to be giving some guidance to close friends who are now facing a coroner's inquest. Where there is a death, they didn't realise something had happened to their relative that actually contributed to the death, and now they're getting lots of information coming out in a coroner's inquest that they knew nothing about. And I say this should not still be happening. But in essence, things are perhaps still helpful to them, because there's no win, no fee insurance. As long as you can show that you have a reasonably good case, likely to succeed, then you may find a lawyer that will help you with the case. But it's challenging to get a true no win, no fee without you perhaps having to pay something for initial investigations before they can take you on a no win, no fee. So I think there's likely to be an initial outlay of something.
Are we talking about a few hundred pounds or what?
I think it's more likely to be closer to £1,000 really to get some initial work done to get the medical records and to get an initial view from another medical expert. In this area, it is the same medical expert that is assessing the competency of the other medic that treated the particular patient. And so you need one of those very senior people to express a view whether they consider there is a falling below of the standards.
Okay, Gary, I keep stopping you talking about the therapy thing. But can you talk about that now? And what was this that you were involved in setting up, something you were saying was quite important in the city to do with helping people through counselling, that kind of thing?
So I'd been working for Relate, did my training mostly through Relate, because my priority really was very much relationships.
Now, Relate deals with people who are having difficulties with marriages, difficulties within the family, doesn't it? I mean, maybe you could just explain who they
are. Relate is probably one of the largest counselling organisations in the country, with branches throughout the country. And predominantly, it's working with individuals, with couples and with families in relation to conflicts or a lower quality of relational life for any of those people, and they can attend a Relate Centre and get therapy for them, for their relationship, or for the family, in terms of helping them to get to a better quality of life. So relationship, Relate is really a significant organization in this country. Having done my training with Relate, I have now moved on to become a private therapist. I have an office just off Portland Square where I'm a relationship counselor. I went on to train in sex therapy, which is something a lot of people really have a greater need of now. Perhaps I'll explain why later.
Well, also before that, you were hit the headlines, didn't you, a couple of months ago, as someone who was removed from their job because of your faith. Tell us about that.
Yes, I 2008, so Tony, it's over 5 years now of my life. I was asked to express a view because at the time I decided to go on to train as a sex therapist, and I was a trainee at the time. I was not refusing to provide services to anybody, but the manager at Relate, Avon, asked for my view in the provision of sex therapy to same-sex couples. I have been a Christian for some 30-odd years. I hadn't really thought about my views at that time, but I was really pushed against the wall, in a sense, metaphorically speaking, to express a view before I'd even know what my view was. And push come to shove, I said, well, I will face a conflict if I have to provide the service to same-sex couples, because I see a conflict with my faith. However, if the issue becomes a reality at some later date, I will work it through in supervision, take it to the manager, and just see where we come to. I was told I could not be believed, and eventually, through various processes, I was dismissed for gross misconduct. And so I had to leave Relate and not finish my qualification, my diploma, etc.
So it just sounds a little bit unfair. I mean, you fought that, I imagine, and being a lawyer, I would imagine you gave it a pretty good crack.
5 years on, a lot of expense from those that backed my case and helped me to. But it was never really, Tony, about Gary McFarlane. This was really about multicultural Britain and the fact that we will face this type of conflict in our society, in our Bristol community, time and time again. There's nothing really that novel about my case in that sense, because there's a civil ceremony registrar, for example. Same-sex civil ceremonies came in when this particular registrar had been in place for quite a long time. She was now required to perform civil ceremonies as a registrar and had a conscientious problem as a Christian. She lost her job. My case followed her case. As she lost, I lost on the basis of precedence. We're going to face this problem of conflicts time and time again. We've got to find a better way to try and balance the competing interests. And that's all that I was seeking the courts to do. But I was not successful fully.
Well, it sounds to me like discrimination. You know, one would have thought that it fell under the laws of discrimination against people. I mean, you know, people who are discriminated against on a basis of their sexuality, for example, or faith.
The court absolutely disagrees with you, Tony, and absolutely disagrees with me, and would say there is no discrimination. And indeed, many of the listeners, of course, will see me as a very bad person, and I shouldn't be in this field anyway.
Well, I don't think not necessarily, no. Anyway, you were saying that you got involved in Relate and you started looking at sex counselling. Why?
It's the strangest thing. I found myself interested in talking about sex for many, many years. I don't know where it came from. Many people, this isn't really over the dinner table stuff of conversations, but I just felt comfortable talking about it. And I recognize that a whole lot of people are really messed up and just not getting the best out of something which is actually very, very, very nice. I'm a married man, but I realized I had something to say and to help people. And this was just me finding my calling. I guess I went into the law for various reasons as a youngster, a lot of it actually to please parents, to get through the academic, etc. And later in life, you reassess life and you say, actually, why am I doing this? Is paying the school fees, the mortgage, good enough reason? And I decided, no, it's not. And I did the career change into an area that I realized I get satisfaction from, talking about it. And then I move on to training sex addiction issues and the internet.
So, I mean, I know you also train people to sort of wean themselves off of internet addiction, things like Facebook, that kind of thing. But let's stick with the sex stuff for the time being. What is the sex addiction?
Do you want me to talk about sex addiction or sex therapy? Sex addiction?
Okay, first. Okay, yeah.
Which one? Sex addiction. Okay. The sex addiction is, we have seen a massive increase in the use of internet pornography. Of course, there are different outlets for sex addiction. It could be prostitution. It could be cyber sex using the webcams. A permeation of different ways that people are using sex in order to deal with life's issues. And in essence, what I say is sex addiction is not really about sex. It is another addiction. And addictions are ways to cope with the excesses of life's issues. It's a way of soothing anxiety, stresses. But most of these problems were set up from childhood. And it's trying to help people to understand how it got set up and what actually they are using it to do, what the function it serves, so that it's actually taken over their lives. Many no longer want it, but are truly addicted and cannot stop. And they need some help using processes like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. What I'm thinking about constantly is what I'm likely to go on to behave. And it's trying to show, let's think about trying to change the cognitive thinking, all the stuff that you're constantly thinking about, and let's put in place some new behaviors, new practices, so that we can start to see some changes in your life.
Well, I mean, pornography is something that's really got a lot bigger since the sort of probably 60s and 70s. There was a kind of laissez-faire attitude to this kind of thing, and it was seen as a kind of censorship, saying that pornography shouldn't be around. So what's your view on it?
I don't come in at the level of having the need to express a view. The fact is, it is here. But before the internet, there were barriers, there were restrictions, there were some things that were in place that actually stopped a significant number of people ever acted upon something that was actually dormant inside of them. In other words, most would need to go to a newsagent outside of the area where they live, make sure they're not seen, not known, and dare to buy a porn magazine, and then perhaps look at it a one time, few times, maybe destroy it before they get home, different things like that. Enter the internet, late 80s, early 90s. And what we now have is the privacy of the home. And of course, the way that men are wired, so that we are stimulated really by the visual, by the sight. And as soon as that stimulating sight of a naked, whatever it may be, woman or man, goes straight through the visual cortex of the eyes, it goes straight into the brain. And what it's doing then, Tony, is it's actually releasing some biochemicals, dopamine, adrenaline, various types of self-produced, self-manufactured chemicals in the brain, that is swamping the pleasure zones of the brain. And in essence, it's taking offline the cognitive, logical, adult reasoning that says, I really shouldn't do this. I'm in the work office using the work computer. I must stop.
It's almost like switching your brain off and something else is taking over, maybe.
And you don't even know that has happened.
Okay. Now, what about ways of dealing with this? I mean, you know, obviously, you as a therapist are able to help people through it. But I mean, is it possible to get off this addiction without too much difficulty?
It's possible to get off this addiction. The last bit you said, without too much difficulty. No, this is long-term work. You know, don't expect any form of cure within a period of something like 6 months. Because just looking at the basic concept of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, it will take a minimum of 6 months to start to change any type of behavior. And what we must remember, Tony, is this was set up from childhood. We are not talking about a sexualized child necessarily. We are talking about behavior traits that the young child learned and then practiced in order to deal with difficulties, traumas in their life as children. And then as they get older, some triggers start to happen to make those behaviors become a more adult, sexualized way of dealing with life's problems.
But isn't it quite a lot to do with loneliness, not having a partner, simply that?
That's only a part of it for those that are without partners. Many, though, are in good relationships. If we take the example that was in the media, Tiger Woods, even Halle Berry's partner in the long past, attractive model type females, and yet you will find so many of the men absolutely addicted to pornography. It's not about the woman, it's about the fact that the men have learned ways to cope with life's adversities, which are inappropriate ways, unfortunately.
Okay, what about Facebook addiction? Because this is probably there's a lot of people out there. I mean, I was just on the way to the studio here today, and there was a man stood on the roundabout, Lawrence Hill roundabout there, completely motionless. This is probably about my age, about 50. And all the time I was sitting there in the traffic jam, he didn't move. He was just looking into his phone. He was dialing it, looking on the internet or something. Who knows? Maybe someone had sent something to him on Facebook, one of his friends. But it is becoming an obsession, isn't it? Is this necessarily a bad thing?
It's not necessarily a bad thing until we look at the underlying cause and purpose and function that it's serving. And so I'm coming at that Facebook and social media, Tony, from the perspective of the females, of women, and love addiction. That very much is what love addiction is. Not broken yet. It's a concept we talk about, but actually society doesn't really recognize it. What we're dealing with is mostly females who, because you see, that's rather different to porn. Men, the visual stimulating, women much more the romance and the conversation and building relationships. So they will go onto the Friends Unite or Reunite, they will go onto the Facebook. Let's say they're in a partnered relationship, but their core needs, as we call it, are not being met. The man, if it is a man in the relationship, is not really giving her the sense of romance, appreciation, value. And so many will gravitate to get their core needs met through some other means. There will be the fighting, more conflicts, or flighting, moving away from a place where your needs are not being met into another place where it is more likely to be met and you feel valued, etc. Enter the scene of the social media, where you can make and build relationships with others, males perhaps, who actually compliment you, give you the things you're not getting in the home. So when you are now doing this 6 hours a day and you can't wait to get home, or doing it in the workplace and you're neglecting your sleep, indeed you can't wait to get the kids to bed so that you can actually just get onto the social media, there may be some problem there, because it's actually feeding something that is a deficit in one's life.
But it's called the World Wide Web, isn't it? It's almost like you're a fly and you're stuck in it. You can't get away from it.
But it's also a good tool. It's with all of these things as human beings, something very good can also become our master. It should actually always remain our servant.
Well, let's hope so. But, I mean, is it fairly easy to help people to get away from this? Or does it mean really dealing with your relationships at home, dealing with real one-to-one relationships rather than ones on the internet. And also, of course, Facebook has got a sort of sinister side to it, in that this is giving a lot of personal information away about who you are. You're telling Facebook Corporation about your darkest, innermost secrets.
Absolutely. And I guess we're consenting to it. But I won't likely see many women that will recognize love addiction, because some scare story hasn't broken yet, like the Tiger Woods, to bring it to the fore. So love addiction is, I think, some way away. You've got to read a catastrophic story of a woman on Facebook, hours, the children neglected, taken into care, some scare story like that, and somebody builds up a picture that actually this is all caused because she was on. Nothing is broken like that yet, and maybe a little way away, and we hope it doesn't. But where we're likely to see it as therapists is because the relationship has broken down, and each of them have gone their different ways to find other ways to meet their needs. But actually, they do want each other, love each other, care about each other, but they've gone their separate ways. One perhaps into porn, the other into the love addiction. One day they may lift their head up and say, let's get some help, let's get some third-party therapy, and that's where somebody like me would come on board, but not likely the love addiction angle immediately.
I suppose the thing is, this is relatively new technology, isn't it?
It's still relatively new, and it is pretty scary what one can do with this technology and what is out there causing some pretty turmoil in a lot of relationships, because it's not handled very well.
Okay, Gary, I'm sure it is handled well around at your place. If people want to find out a bit more about you and your practice, how can they get hold of you?
You can get hold of me. The website is garymcfarlane.com. My phone number is 0786-609-7247. I'm just commencing, Tony, on the 15th of June, one of the first workshops for women-only partners of those with sex addiction. So it's the women partners of the males that are sex addicts to come along to a workshop at 10:30 on Saturday morning, the 15th of June, at my office. Is highly confidential, so you'd have to register women beforehand, and it's a workshop to help women to better understand the terrain of sex addiction. Probably only a handful of these types of groups in the whole country, because we are all still learning how to handle and do therapy for sex addiction.
Well, Gary, we'll give your phone number and your website again at the end of the program, but thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Privilege, thank you.
Well, back to last month now, and the May Day rally by Bristol Trades Council in Castle Park. And this week we hear from Rowena Haywood, who's from the General Municipal and Boilermakers Union, and that is abbreviated to the GMB.
Thank you. The reason we're here today is because the poor are paying the most. Is the Queen's speech. The government outlines its plans and announces its agenda for the next year. With 2 years into a general election, we will all watch with interest, no doubt, whatever words the government dresses its policies up in. It's clear that voters, that its policies are not working. We only have to see how the local elections went this week, where both Lib Dems and Tories lost seats. Why did they lose so many seats? We know why. The austerity cuts are affecting those people who can least afford to take these cuts. Last year, almost 330,000 people used a food bank. One in five mums skipped meals to feed their children. 20% of the population live in poverty. That cannot be right anywhere, but especially in a country as rich as this one. This government is clever. Aided by a hostile press and funded by millionaire backers, they continue to hit the poor hardest. We need to be pushing for more jobs. We need to be pushing for investment to kickstart our economy and help make work pay. We need to be tackling rip-off energy bills and train fares, as many people are struggling to pay their heating bills. We need to have action against rogue landlords, rip off letting agents and build more houses. We need to stop unscrupulous employers undertaking wages, undercutting wages, and include enhanced national minimum wage enforcement and an extension of Gangmasters Licensing Agency. The Tory-led government has now had 3 years in office in which it has shown it is out of touch with the British people and run out of ideas on how to turn this country around. They carry on regardless with a failed economic plan which has seen manufacturing output fall in the last two quarters, making it significantly harder to get people back to work. More public sector jobs are being lost and workers' hours reduced, as well as terms and conditions being slashed. We have to work together to push for these changes to improve working people's lives and ensure the most vulnerable in our society are not the ones paying the price for those who avoid paying tax and receive big bonuses. We have to send a clear message back to this government. We do not trust you and we will fight you.
Thank you. Well, that was Rowena Hayward there from Bristol GMB, General Municipal Boilermakers Union. I think they just call themselves a GMB nowadays, with a rebel-rousing speech on Castle Park. And sticking with the politics, I'm joined by Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello, Tony.
Now, you've got some positive action stuff for this week. And this is one of the things with, you know, what we've just heard there is a tirade against the Conservative government. I mean, I don't really think you can... Yeah, I suppose it's a coalition, just about. But anyway, the Conservatives seem to be sort of in the driving seat. Lib Dems sitting in the back seat. But from a political point of view, it's a bit depressing, isn't it? What about positive action? What can we do? You know, it's saying that it's 20%... people in Britain, one of the richest countries of the world, are actually now living below the poverty line. They're talking about the hostile press. Well, they're not talking about us because we're not the hostile press. What can we do?
Well, it's interesting. Positive action is about standing up for what you believe in. Positive action is about fighting for issues that need a lot of campaigning. It's about getting there and showing and demonstrating what you know to be right. It's about actually getting there, and in this case we're looking at equality of the people and all the people. So in this case it can be promoting equality, you know, closing that gap between the rich and the poor.
Yeah, so when you say demonstrating, does that mean going out on the street, having a rally? I suppose the fact of that is you're actually together with a lot of people. That can actually make you feel a bit better, can't it? That you're not being isolated, you're not on your own.
It certainly makes you feel bolder. It's not necessarily going out and demonstrating in that sense, although that does work and is effective. I mean, it can be any form of method, as long as it has the desired impact, as long as it shows that you are willing to campaign on this issue a long way. Now, I recently applied for a job with the National Autistic Society, and the National Autistic Society, through positive action, through their own lobbying, forced the Autism Act of 2009, which made legislation in as much as the government created legislation that was made to assist autistic people. And this is a wonderful case of positive action because it's the first piece of legislation that's to deal with a specific disability.
You know what? I think sometimes one of the things with watching the news every day can actually make you quite depressed, can't it? You see what looks to be social injustice. So you've just given an example of something which is social justice. New legislation for a particular part of society that's in some way just basically ignored and treated like everybody else, but actually they need to have special treatment. Have you ever seen yourself, other than the autism business, any kind of positive action that's actually had a positive outcome? Because the spin that we often get is that really we don't have the power to change things. Only the government can do that.
Well, anyone has the power to change things I think at the 2005 general election, there was one seat which came down to the top two candidates having exactly the same number of votes, and they literally had to pull a vote out of the hat to decide who won the seat. So even as much as one vote can change it, but if you want something more, if you want more examples of positive action, you only have to look at history. In things like the suffragette movement, the black civil rights movement in America, the Stonewall riots.
Tell us about the Stonewall riots. I've not heard of those.
Stonewall riots. That happened in a pub called Stonewall, and this was lesbian gay activists pushing for equal rights when a lesbian gay institution. I think either the town was called Stonewall or the pub was called Stonewall. I can't remember which. But they actually rioted there. They had UCL protests because they were planning on shutting this pub down, and it forced intrusion, it forced a change in opinion.
Ah, I see. So they're kind of using the media, aren't they? But then what Rowena was saying there from the trade unionists is that you've got a hostile press, it's very difficult.
Well, hostile press regardless, you have to get your voice out. I mean, a lot of places like Syria or Egypt had a hostile press. Because this is the way the press works, you know. If a protest happens in another country, then it could be people looking for what they consider to be right they deserve, or it could be democracy fighters. But when it happens in this country, they're lefties and terrorists and must be ignored, you know.
Well, that's the press. But, I mean, how do you think we're going to change this and get more social justice then? I mean, have you got any thoughts on that one?
There's numerous ways you can do it. I mean, there's that whole business that's going on now through causes on Facebook, where you write a letter or something, or put your signature to campaign. There's going out and protesting. There's just contacting your local officials and making a point.
I suppose really the watchword on all of this is trust your own instincts, trust your own what you think is right and wrong, and don't be sort of persuaded by the fact that you're just one person in a big sea.
Absolutely not, because one person can make all the difference. I mean, just look at some cases where one person's made all the difference. I mean, if you mentioned, I mentioned the Black Civil Rights Movement earlier, if you mention that, people will say Martin Luther King. I mentioned the suffragettes, people will say Emmeline Pankhurst. It's one case where there's lots of people involved in it, but one person just symbolise a whole movement. And it can be a really beautiful thing. And in some cases, it's not just one person, it can be a lot of people. I'm going to reference the Paralympics from last year, and the actual good that's done to people's view on disability. I mean, actually, if you look at this government since they came in, before the Paralympics, that period from 2010 to 2012, people had a horrible view of disability because everyone saw them as sponging off the state. And some people still see them as that, but since the Paralympics, people have seen the actual positive side of it, the positive side of having a disability.
Well, Jason, fascinating. Thanks very much. One little thing I'd like to talk about, since we're going out on the day of the Bilderberg meeting, do you know about? I love asking people if they've ever heard of the Bilderbergers, because yes. I've done a website starting back in about 1995, 1996. I put information about this little group up, and over the years, I've been finding out more and more about them. All of it pretty much
shifty little group, aren't
bad.
They?
Yes, they're very shifty. What do you know about them?
Bilderberg Group, from what I can understand, it's a group that meets, I think, about once a year, usually somewhere in Switzerland, from what I've understood.
Well, it's in the NATO countries. This is becoming
It's in the NATO countries. The last one was in Switzerland. I don't know where this one is. It's the world leaders. I mean, some of the big ones, like Barack Obama, and previous ones like George W. Bush and David Cameron and Tony Blair, news group bosses like Rupert Murdoch and the royalty and people like that. And these people, about once a year, they meet up for a meeting that is unrecorded. No one records what's said. They have discussions, but no record is made. It's unminuted. Chatham House rules. What's said in that meeting stays in that meeting. And it's very shady, because it's the most important, powerful people from military, from business, from very rich people, and these people are meeting once a year, and they're having off-record discussions, and we're not entitled to know what they're discussing.
Well, I've got news for you. It's Watford.
Is it in the UK?
It's in
this
the UK
year?
This year.
No.
In Watford. Sunny Watford. Charlie Skelton's covering it, if anyone's interested, in The Guardian. In a most entertaining and enlightening fashion, taking the mickey as usual. One of his famous comments, Charlie's, was, I think, last year, where they started taking photographs of the meeting. And the hotel authorities were worried that they might be photographing people through the windows. And so this enormous, great kind of, I suppose it's a kind of curtain rail thing, appeared from behind the hotel and came out between the photographers and the they actually put this kind of curtain rail thing right round the front of the hotel so that nobody could actually photograph into the windows to see who was in there. Now this worries me, because what it suggests is that quite possibly there are people in that meeting that they're not saying are even in there. That's why they don't want the photographs taken. Suddenly,
you mean like, say, Freemason leaders?
Well, I'm thinking more about, you know, really big political leaders, like someone like David Cameron. It won't necessarily be declared to be there, but you know, if someone can take a photograph of him through there. I mean, I say this because back in 1998, where the last time this meeting happened in Britain, it happened up in Scotland at the Turnberry Hotel.
This is a G8 meeting, wasn't it?
It's just the G8 meeting is just after the Bilderberg. Many people say that actually the G8 meeting is a bit of a waste of time, and the big decisions are really made at the Bilderberg.
£50 million of UK fitting security bill for that one.
£50 million.
Yeah.
Oh, that's where your taxpayers' money's going, folks. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so but even though he wasn't on the list, Prime Minister of the day, Tony Blair, was there. And the reason I know is because I spoke to the woman who served him breakfast on the Saturday morning.
It's incredible, because if you look at worldtruth.tv, it's got a list of everyone involved in the Bilderberg. And David Cameron is on that list. Blair is on that list. Rupert Murdoch was on the list.
Well, and also, if Murdoch's not there, his chief executive, general manager for News Corporation or News
there.
International is there. Microsoft are there. Twitter are there.
The royal family are there, many of them.
Google are there. Who else? Amazon, Google, Twitter.
Living US presidents.
LinkedIn are there. I mean, it is quite an amazing bunch of people.
LinkedIn,
I know, it's frightening, isn't it? I'm going to delete my account too. Yeah, but Peter Thiel's there, who funded many of these. He funded Facebook, for example, originally. So they're all in the same little place. The problem, the reason that I, you know, got upset with them though, Jason, was really when I discovered that the first chairman of the Bilderberg back in 1954 was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former officer in the SS.
Oh,
and he was the chairman for the first 20 years. So that really, to me, rings alarm bells. If you're going to have a meeting that's chaired by a former SS officer and try and make out it's all trustworthy and fine for it all to be secret and, you know, just kind of go away. And the other thing is, of course, it might influence, you know, future leaders. For example, Bill Clinton went to the Bilderberg conference the year before he got the Democratic nomination.
Funny that.
Tony Blair went to the Bilderberg the year before he was elected leader of the Labour Party.
And you know who went to the one in, I think it was 2010? Do you know the 2010 one?
Nope.
Mitt Romney.
Oh. You've got one over me. The other thing is, once Bernhard was chairing these meetings, and he actually got disgraced in the Lockheed scandal in 1975, which is a terribly, terrible shame, because he was caught taking $1 million bribe. And he says, you've got to trust the Bilderbergs. But he took $1 million bribe from Lockheed to get the Dutch Air Force to buy Lockheed Starfighter jets, which, by the way, were rubbish and kept falling out of the sky. But anyway, he got his $1 million, and this was discovered by a chambermaid in his hotel, found a little bit of paper in his wastebasket, which proved that he'd taken this $1 million. He made some notes or something. So that was the end of Bernhard as the chairman. They had a gap for a year, and then who took over but Peter Carrington.
Oh my word.
Peter Carrington, Lord Carrington, he was Captain Carrington in the Grenadier Guards during the Second World War at Arnhem, when it all went disastrously wrong. Nijmegen,
Was this the man, as we were pushing through, I think they're about to cross a bridge, and that would have cut the
It was the bridge too far, yeah.
Yeah, and it was the bridge too far, and he was the one that called halt, wasn't he?
Well, what happened was, they'd got over to the... They'd captured the Nijmegen Bridge. The American 82nd Airborne Division had captured it. I actually spoken to Moffat T. Burrows, who was a captain in the 82nd Airborne, who made the assault across the river to capture the other end of the bridge. And they'd done this, he'd lost half his men as casualties, and he'd done this in order to take the bridge, because they knew that Arnhem, that the British were dying at Arnhem and collapsing, so they had to get down there fast. Anyway, so they captured the bridge. Lord Carrington came across in his Grenadier Guard tank into Lent, which is on the other side of the bridge, just towards Arnhem, and then stopped. And in the film A Bridge Too Far is an incident with Robert Redford, who goes over to Carrington and says, why aren't you moving? Why aren't you going? And this is exactly what Moffat Burrows told me. He said, but Moffat said that he actually went over to Carrington. He cocked his Tommy gun, pointed it to Lord Carrington's head, and said, get down that blankety blank road now before I blow your head off. But Carrington said, oh no, I can't go any further. I've got to wait for orders to go. And at that point, if he'd have carried on, there was nothing between him and Arnhem, and he could have taken reinforced the British troops in Arnhem. Instead, Carrington waited there and drank tea and sat around for 17 hours until the battle was lost, and then his tanks started moving forward, by which time, of course, the Germans had reinforced the road and the battle was lost. But if they had got a bridgehead across the Rhine, it could well have been meant the end of the war by Christmas 1944 rather than an extra 6 months. So Carrington has a few questions to answer, and Moffat T. Burrows says that his memory is better than Carrington's, because Carrington denies that this gun was ever pointed to his head. In fact, Moffat Burrows said Carrington, after he pointed his gun to Carrington's head, went down inside his tank, locked the tank, and didn't come out all night. So there's a story for you.
Carrington.
Yeah, Carrington stayed in his tank and wouldn't come out. And what Moffat Burrows told me was that I couldn't get at him. Because they were annoyed, you know. They had just lost half their men capturing this bridge, and all the British tanks were doing was sitting around going nowhere. Anyway, it's all in the film A Bridge Too Far. Anyway, that's the end of me waffling on. Thanks very much for all your stuff about positive action, Jason, and speak to you next week.
Thanks, Tony.
Well, I'm joined now by Paul Fernie on our trip through the solar system into the outer reaches of the universe. Last week was Jupiter, but we're not actually going to be leaving, apparently, Paul, are we?
No, we're not. We're not leaving Jupiter quite yet. I feel it would only be right to just go into a little bit of detail around the moons of Jupiter, as quite a big system of them.
Okay, so how many of them are there, and do they actually sort of affect each other? They hit each other with their gravitational doodahs?
Yeah, Jupiter's 67 confirmed moons. Now, a lot of these are quite small objects, captured asteroids, bits where there's been collisions in the past.
A bit of a space junkyard.
Yeah, you could almost call it that. And I mean, a lot of them, although they were all these 67 have stable orbits and therefore can be considered satellites or moons, a lot of them have very eccentric orbits, so they're not as such following the same path. They move and their axes change over periods of time, affected primarily by gravity. Now, the four moons that I'm going to sort of cover in more detail are the Galilean moons.
But before you do, that's a lot of moons, isn't it? I mean, surely every once in a while one is going to hit another one.
Well, no, in a stable orbit, nothing else can share an orbit that something's already in, so it becomes objects that fall into the same orbit generally get ejected out of the orbit at some point by gravity and gravitational forces. So
what about if they're in different orbits? Don't they, you know, one's going one way, one's going the other way, isn't that possible? And or, you know, and then clunk, they hit each other.
I don't suppose it's not possible, but I've not heard of it recently. I mean, at the end of the day, if you think the amount of artificial satellites around Earth, you know, they're all put into particular orbits for that reason.
Okay, so these Galilean moons, what makes them different to the 60? Did you say 67 altogether?
67, yeah, 67 altogether. Now, the Galilean moons were discovered in 1610 by Galileo, hence they became the Galilean moons, and were the first objects found to orbit a body that was neither the Earth or the Sun. Now, these four moons, in order of increasing distance from Jupiter, are Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Now, the first three of those, Io, Europa and Ganymede, actually have an orbital resonance, which means that for every one orbit that Ganymede makes, which is the third one out of of these four, Europa makes two orbits and Io makes four orbits. And this creates a resonance, which basically pulls and drags on the interiors of these moons. So these moons are all actually, barring Callisto, are actually all quite geologically active in one way or another.
By which you mean, potentially anyway, you mean volcanoes, right?
Yes, well, Io, which is the nearest to Jupiter, has a diameter of 2,263 miles, is the fourth largest moon in the solar system, and has four...
How does that compare to our moon? Sorry to interrupt you, but 2,000 miles.
Our moon is 2,160 miles in diameter, basically it's slightly larger.
All right, so roughly the similar
sort
size.
Of similar
though,
yeah. Sort of sizes, yes. Io is the most geologically active object in the solar system. It has 400 active volcanoes. This activity, again, is the result of this tidal heating in the interior caused by it being pulled by Jupiter and the other Galilean moons. The next moon out from Jupiter, which is Europa, is 1900 miles in diameter and is the smallest of the four Galilean moons. It is believed that Europa has either a liquid ocean beneath its icy crust surface, or possibly a warm convecting ice layer beneath that brittle ice surface. Now, Europa's often seen photographed. It has what are called linear on them, which are almost like cracks on the surface, and these show up in natural colour photography as being sort of dark reddish lines. And it's believed again that this tidal heating allows movement in the surface, and therefore allows this liquid from underneath this ice crust to come up to the surface, a bit like they compare it to the same way that the if you're aware of the sort of Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which runs in the Atlantic Ocean, where there's a volcano where the two crust plates sort of moving apart. It's a similar sort of process that they anticipate is causing these linear. They have done some research around the linear to see how the cracks form, in terms of, because obviously there's a solid core to the planet and then there's a liquid ocean and then there's this icy crust around the top, that the icy crust is moving at a different speed to the interior and basically causes these cracks.
Crikey. So yeah, it's Europa. It's a bit of an interesting,
yeah, been
complicated
interesting.
One.
There's a few sort of plans. There has been sort of ideas come up from some of the space agencies to send sort of drilling type spacecraft up there to drill into this ice and to see if they can get down to this deep sort of ocean.
And if they ever come back again.
Maybe there's some extraterrestrial life there. I'm not speculating. It is possible, obviously, if there's water there, because that forms a large
part. How long would you or I last on Europa then, Paul?
Probably not very long, because it hasn't got an atmosphere. It's sort of the surface is there, but there's no atmosphere around that surface. So you could walk on it, but there's no atmosphere.
You better take your oxygen bottle. Don't forget it in your thermos.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, any more moons?
Yeah, there is.
Galilean ones?
The Galilean ones. The third out is Ganymede, which is the largest moon in the solar system. It's the third Galilean moon out from Jupiter. It has a diameter of 3,273 miles.
So they're all pretty hefty, aren't they,
these
moons?
They are. They're all very hefty objects. Now, Ganymede is actually 8% larger than the planet Mercury, so it is a really big moon in terms of the fact it's a satellite and not a planet in its own right. It has the highest mass of all the planetary satellites, with 2.02 times the mass of our own moon. It's quite a big boy, if you like. The surface, again, is primarily cratered and is rocky silicas. And then finally of the Galilean moons is Callisto. Now Callisto isn't affected by this resonance of the others. It's too far out in orbit terms to be affected by the resonance of the other three moons. So it doesn't form part of that system, that 1-2-4 resonance.
Well, the big question is, though, can we see these moons?
We can, absolutely, yes. Galileo discovered them. When Jupiter's visible, you can actually monitor over a period of nights the movement of these moons around Jupiter.
Now, you need a pretty decent telescope.
Not really, a pair of binoculars, and you know, if you sort of take small drawings of the objects as they appear at one time one day, and then take an observation at the same time the following night, you'll see the movement quite clearly.
Fascinating. All right, Paul, thanks very much. Again, next week we'll probably, I think, we'll reach to Saturn.
We will reach Saturn next week, yes.
We hope.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, thanks for
joining us,
Paul.
Depending on how our spacecraft goes.
Cheers, Paul.
Cheers.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. And you can do that or download this podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks very much to our studio guest, Gary McFarlane, MCFARLANE. GaryMcFarlane.com is his website. His number 07866 097247. So that was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till same time next week. Goodbye.
When Jesus wore.